dishonesty or the sin of theft and of injustice. Exodus 20:15, thou shalt not steal. This is one of the Ten Commandments, which constitute a summary of man's duty as revealed by God. God made many revelations to the children of Israel in the wilderness by Moses, but this made in the Ten Commandments is a chief. Most of those other revelations contain ceremonial or judicial laws, but this contains the moral law. The most of those other laws respected the Jewish nation, but here is a summary of laws binding on all mankind. Those were to last till Christ should come and have set up the Christian church. These are of perpetual obligation and last to the end of the world. God everywhere, by Moses and the prophets, manifests a far greater regard to the duties of these commands than to any of the rites of the ceremonial law. These commands were given at Mount Sinai before any of the precepts of the ceremonial or judicial laws. They were delivered by a great voice out of the midst of fire, which made all the people in the camp tremble, and afterwards were engraven on tables of stone and laid up in the ark. The first table containing the four first commandments, which teach our duty to God. The second containing the sixth last, which teach our duty to man. The sum of the duties of the first table is contained in that which Christ says in the first and great commandment of the law. Matthew 22:37. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thine mind. The sum of what is required in the second table is what Christ calls the second command, like unto the first, verse 39. The second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Of the commands of the second table of the law, the first, which is a fifth of the ten, refers to the honor which is due to our neighbor. The second respects his life. The third, his chastity. The fourth, his estate. The fifth, his good name. The sixth and last respect his possessions and enjoyments in general. It is that command which respects our neighbor's estate, and which is the fourth command of the second table and the eighth of the whole Decalogue, on which I am now to insist. And here I shall make the command itself, as the words of it lie before us in the Decalogue, my subject, and as the words of the commandment are in the form of a prohibition forbidding a certain kind of sin, so I shall consider particularly what it is that this command forbids. The sin that is forbidden in this command is called stealing. Yet we cannot reasonably understand it only of that act, which in the more ordinary and strict sense of the word is called stealing. But the iniquity which this command forbids may be summed up thus: an unjust usurping of our neighbor's property without his consent. So much is doubtless comprehended in the text, yet this comprehends much more than is implied in the ordinary use of the word stealing, which is only a secret taken of that which is another's from his possession, without either his consent or knowledge. But the Ten Commands are not to be limited to the strictest sense of the words, but are to be understood in such a latitude as to include all things that are of that nature or kind. Here Christ reproves the Pharisees' interpretation of the sixth command, Matthew 5:21-22, and also their interpretation of the seventh command, see verses 27-28, by which it appears that the commands are not to be understood as forbidding only these individual sins, which are expressly mentioned in the strictest sense of the expressions, but all other things of the same nature or kind. Therefore, what is forbidden in this command is all unjust usurpation of our neighbor's property. Here it may be observed that an unjust usurpation of our neighbor's property is twofold. It may either be withholding what is our neighbor's or taking it from him. Section number one, the dishonesty of withholding what is our neighbor's. There are many ways in which persons may unjustly usurp their neighbor's property by withholding what is his due, but I shall particularize only two things. Number one, the unfaithfulness of men in not fulfilling their engagements. Ordinarily, when men promise anything to their neighbor, or enter into engagements by understanding any business with which their neighbor entrusts them, their engagements invest their neighbor with a right to that which is engaged. so that if they withhold it, they usurp that which belongs to their neighbor. So when men break their promises because they find them to be inconvenient, and they cannot fulfill them without difficulty and trouble, or merely because they have altered their minds since they promised, they think they have not consulted their own interest in the promise which they have made, and that if they had considered the matter as much before they promised as they have since, they should not have promised. Therefore they take the liberty to set their own promises aside. Besides, sometimes persons violate this command by neglecting to fulfill their engagements through a careless, negligent spirit. They violate this command in withholding what belongs to their neighbor when they are not faithful in any business which they have undertaken to do for their neighbor. If their neighbor have hired them to labor for him for a certain time, and they be not careful well to husband the time, if they be hired to a day's labor and be not careful to improve the day, as they have reason to think that he who hired justly expected of them, or if they be hired to accomplish such a piece of work and be not careful to do it well, do it not as if it were for themselves, or as they would have others do for them, when they in like manner betrust them with any business of theirs, or if they be entrusted with any particular affair which they undertake, but use not that care, contrivance, and diligence to manage it so as will be to the advantage of him who entrusts them, and as they would manage it or would insist that it should be managed, if the affair was their own, in all these cases they unjustly withhold what belongs to their neighbor. Number two, another way in which men unjustly withhold what is their neighbor's is in neglecting to pay their debts. Sometimes this happens because they run so far into debt that they cannot reasonably hope to be able to pay their debts. And this they do either through pride and affection of living above their circumstances, or through a grasping, covetous disposition, or some other corrupt principle. Sometimes they neglect to pay their debts from carelessness of spirit about it, little concerning themselves whether they are paid or not, taking no care to go to their creditor or to send to him, and if they see him from time to time, they say nothing about their debts. Sometimes they neglect to pay their debts because it would put them into some inconvenience. The reason why they do not do it is not because they cannot do it, but because they cannot do it so conveniently as they desire, and so they rather choose to put their creditor to inconvenience by being without what properly belongs to him, than to put themselves to inconvenience by being without what doth not belong to them, and what they have no right to detain. In any of these cases, they unjustly usurp the property of their neighbor. Sometimes persons have that by them with which they could pay their debts if they would, but they want to lay out their money for something else, to buy gay clothing for their children, or to advance their estates, or for some such end. They have other designs in hand which must fail if they pay their debts. When men thus withhold what is due, they unjustly usurp what is not their own. Sometimes they neglect to pay their debts, and their excuse for it is that their creditor doth not need it, that he hath a plentiful estate and can well bear to lie out of his money. But if the creditor be ever so rich, that gives no right to the debtor to withhold from him that which belongs to him. If it be due, it ought to be paid, for that is the very notion of its being due. It is no more lawful to withhold from a man what is his due without his consent because he is rich and able to do without it, than it is lawful to steal from a man because he is rich and able to bear the loss. Section number two, the dishonesty of unjustly taking a neighbor's property. The principal ways of doing this seem to be these four:
by negligence,
by fraud, by violence, or by stealing, strictly so called. Number one, the first way of unjustly depriving our neighbor of that which is his is by negligence, by carelessly neglecting that which is expected by neighbors one of another, and is necessary to prevent our neighbor's suffering in his estate by us, or by anything that is ours, and necessary in order that neighbors may live one by another, without suffering in their lawful interests, rights, and possessions one by another. For instance, when proper care is not taken by men to prevent their neighbor's suffering in the produce of his fields or enclosures from their cattle or other brute creatures,
which may be either through negligence with regard to their creatures themselves, and keeping those that are unruly, and giving them their liberty, though they know that they are not fit to have their liberty, and are commonly wont to break into their neighbor's enclosures greatly to his damage, or through a neglect of that which is justly expected of them, to defend others' fields from suffering by the neighborhood of their own. In such cases, men are guilty of unjustly taking from their neighbor what is his property. Number two, taking away that which is our neighbor's by fraud or by deceiving him is another mode of usurping our neighbor's property. This is the case when men in their dealings take advantage of their neighbor's ignorance or oversight or mistake to get something from them, or when they make their gains by concealing the defects of what they sell, putting off bad for good, though this be not done by speaking falsely, but only by keeping silence, or when they take a higher price than what they sell is really worth, and more than they could get for it if the concealed defects were known, or when they sell that for good, which indeed is not merchantable, which is condemned in Amos 8:6, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat. If a man puts off something to another with defects that are concealed, knowing that the other receives it as good and pays such a price for it, under a notion of its having no remarkable defect but what he sees, and takes a price which the buyer under that notion offers, the seller knows that he takes a price of the buyer for that which the buyer had not of him, for the buyer is deceived and pays for those things which he finds wanting in what he buys. It is just the same thing as if a man should take a payment that another offers him through a mistake for that which he never had of him, thinking that he had it of him when he had it not. So a man fraudulently takes away that which is his neighbor's when he gets his money from him by falsely commending what he has to sell above what he knows to be the true quality of it, and attributes those good qualities to it which he knows it has not. Or if he does not that, yet sets forth the good qualities in a degree beyond what he knows to be the true degree, or speaks of the defects and ill qualities of what he has to sell, as if they were much less than he knows they are, or on the contrary, when the buyer will cry down what he is about to buy, contrary to his real opinion of the value of it. These things, however common they be in men's dealings one with another, are nothing short of iniquity and fraud, and a great breach of this commandment upon which we are discoursing. Proverbs 20, verse 14. It is not, saith the buyer, but when he has gone his way, then he boasteth. Many other ways there are whereby men deceive one another in their trading, and whereby they fraudulently and unjustly take away that which is their neighbor's. Number three, another mode of unjustly invading and taking away our neighbor's property is by violence. This violence may be done in different degrees. Men may take away their neighbor's goods either by mere open violence, either making use of superior strength, forcibly taking away anything that is his, or by express or implicit threatening, forcing him to yield up what he has into their hands, as is done in open robbery and piracy, or by making use of some advantages which they have over their neighbor in their dealings with him, constrain him to yield to their gaining unreasonably of him, as when they take advantage of their neighbor's poverty to extort unreasonably from him for those things that he is under a necessity of procuring for himself or family. This is an oppression against which God has shown a great displeasure in his word, Leviticus 25, verse 14. And if thou sell aught unto thy neighbor, or buyest aught of thy neighbor, ye shall not oppress one another. Proverbs 22, verses 22 and 23. Rob not the poor, because he is poor, neither oppress the afflicted in the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoil them. And Amos 4, 1 and 2, hear this word, ye kind of Bashan, that are in the mount of Samaria, which oppress the poor, which crush the needy. The Lord has sworn in his holiness that he will take you away with hooks, and your posterity with fishhooks. When the necessity of poor indigent people is the very thing when others take occasion to raise the price of provisions, even above the market, this is such an oppression. There are many poor people whose families are in such necessity of bread that they in their extremity will give almost any price for it rather than go without it. Those who have to sell, though hereby they have an advantage in their hands, yet surely should not take the advantage to raise the price of provisions. We should doubtless think that we had just cause to complain, if we were in such necessity as they are, and were reduced to their straits, and were treated in this manner. And let us remember that it is owing only to the distinguishing goodness of God to us that we are not in their circumstances. And whatever our present circumstances are, yet we know not but that the time will still come when their case may be ours. Men may oppress others, though they be not poor, if they will take advantage of any particular necessities of their neighbor, unreasonably to extort from him. The case may be so at particular seasons, that those who are not poor may stand in particular an extraordinary need of what we have, or what we can do for them, so that it would be greatly to their disadvantage or loss to be without it. Now, to take advantage of their urgent circumstances, to get from them an unreasonable price, is a violent dealing with our neighbors. It is very unreasonable to say, such men are so rich and get money so much more easily than I, that it is no hurt for me to take advantage when they are in special need, and make them give me, for work that I do for them, a great deal more than I would desire to ask of other men. Let such consider whether, if they should by any means hereafter get forward in the world, and come to have plentiful estates, they would like that person should act upon such principles towards them. That men are rich gives us no more right to take away from them what is theirs in this way than it does to steal from them because they come easily by their property and can do without it better than we. Again, another thing that is a kind of violent taken from our neighbor what is taken the advantage of the law to gain from others when their cause is honesty and conscience is just and good. The circumstances of mankind, their rights, possessions, and dealings one with another are so various that it is impossible that any body of human law should be contrived to suit all possible cases and circumstances. Hence, the best laws may be abused and perverted to purposes contrary to the general design of laws, which is to maintain the rights and secure the properties of mankind. Human laws have a regard due to them, but always in subordination to the higher laws of God and nature. Therefore, when it so happens that we have an advantage by the law to gain what the laws of moral honesty allow not, it is an oppression and violence to take the advantage. That human laws allow it will not excuse us before God, the judge of the world, who will judge us another day by his own laws and not by the laws of the commonwealth. Number four, the fourth way of unjustly taking from our neighbor that which is his is stealing, so-called. All unjust ways of taking away or invading or usurping what is our neighbor's are called stealing in the most extensive use of the word. And all is included in the expression in this command. Yet the word stealing, as it is more commonly used, is not of so great extent, and intends not all unjust invasion of our neighbor's property, but only a particular kind of unjust taking. So that in common speech, when we speak of fraudulent dealings, of extortion, unfaithfulness in our trust, and of stealing, we understand different sins by these expressions, though they are an usurpation of what is our neighbor's. Stealing, strictly so-called, may be thus defined: a design taken of our neighbor's goods from him without his consent or knowledge. It is not merely a withholding of what is our neighbor's, but a taking away, and therein it differs from unfaithfulness in our undertaking and betrustments, and also from negligence in the payment of debts. It is a designed or willful depriving of our neighbor of what is his, and so differs from wronging our neighbor in his estate through carelessness or negligence. It is a taking of our neighbor's goods without his knowledge. It is a private, clandestine taking away, and so differs from robbery by open violence. So also it differs from extortion, for in that the person knows what is taken from him. The aim of him that takes is no other than that he should know it, for he makes use of other means than his ignorance to obtain what is his neighbor's, violence to constrain him to give it up. So also it differs from fraudulent dealing or trading. For though in fraudulent dealing the lawful possessor doth not understand the ways and means by which he parts with his goods, and by which his neighbor becomes possessed of them, yet he knows the fact. The deceiver designedly conceals the manner only. But in stealing, strictly so called, he that takes intends not that it shall be known that he takes. It also differs from extortion and fraudulent dealing in that it is wholly without the consent of the owner. For in extortion, though there be no free consent, yet the consent of the owner is in some sort gained, though by oppressive means. So in fraudulent dealing, consent is in some sort obtained, though it be by deceit, but in stealing no kind of consent is obtained. A person may steal from another, yet not take his goods without the knowledge of the owner. Because he may know of it accidentally, he may see what is done, unawares, to the thief. Therefore I have defined stealing, a design taken without the consent or knowledge of the owner. If it be accidentally known, yet it is not known in the design and intention of the thief. The thief is so far at least private in it, that he gives no notice to the owner at the time. It must be also without the consent of the owner. A person may take without the knowledge of the owner, and yet not take without his consent. The owner may not know of his taking at the time, or of his taking any particular things, yet there may be his implicit consent. There may have been a general consent, if not expressed, yet implied. The circumstances of the affair may be such that his consent may well be presumed upon, either from an established custom, allowed by all, or from the nature of the case, the thing being of such a nature that it may well be presumed that none would refuse their consent, as in the case of a person's accidentally passing through his neighbor's vineyard in Israel and eating his fill of grapes, or from the circumstances of the persons, as is the case in many instances, of the freedom which near neighbors and intimate friends often take, and of that boldness which they use with respect to each other's goods. In all such cases, though the owner do not particularly know what is done, yet he that takes does it not with any contrived design concealment. And though there is no express particular consent, yet there is a consent either implied or justly presumed upon, and he that takes does not designedly do it without consent. It may happen in some cases that one may take the goods of another both without his knowledge and consent, either explicit or implicit, but through mistake, yet he may not be guilty of stealing. Therefore, the design of him who takes must come into consideration. When he designedly takes away that which is his neighbor's without his consent or knowledge, then he steals. So that if it should happen that he has both his consent and knowledge without his design, he steals. And if it so happen that he takes without either his neighbor's consent or knowledge, and yet without his own design, he steals not. I desire, therefore, that this, which I take to be the true definition of theft or stealing, may be borne in mind, a design taken of our neighbor's goods without his consent or knowledge, because it is needful to clear up many things which I have yet to say on this subject. Section 3. Dishonest Excuses. Here I shall particularly take notice of some things by which persons may be ready to excuse themselves in privately taking their neighbor's goods, which, however, cannot be a just excuse for it, nor will they make such a taking to be stealing. Number one, that the person whose goods are privately taken owes or is in debt to him that takes them. Some may be ready to say that they do not take that which is their neighbor's, they take that which is their own, because as much is due to them, their neighbor owes them as much and unjustly detains it, and they know not whether ever they shall get their due of him. Their neighbor will not do them right, and therefore they must right themselves. But such pleas as these will not justify a man in going in a private and clandestine manner to take away anything of his neighbor's from his possession without his consent or knowledge. His doing this is properly stealing. For though something of his neighbor's, which is as valuable as what he takes, may be due to him, that doth not give him such a right to his neighbor's goods, that he may take anything that is his according to his own pleasure, and at what time and in what manner he pleases. That his neighbor is in debt to him does not give him a right to take it upon himself to be his own judge, so that he may judge for himself which of his neighbor's goods shall be taken from him to discharge the debt, and that he may act merely according to his own private judgment and pleasure in such a case, without so much as acquainting his neighbor with the affair. In order to warrant such a proceeding as this, everything that his neighbor has must be his. A man may not take indifferently what he pleases out of a number of goods without the consent or knowledge of any other person, unless all is his own to be disposed of as he pleases. Such a way of using goods according to our own pleasure, taking what we will and at what time we will, can be warranted by nothing but a dominion over the whole. And though he who is in debt may be guilty of great injustice in detaining what is due to another, yet it does not thence follow, but that he that takes from him may also be guilty of great injustice towards him. The course he takes to right himself may be very irregular and unreasonable, and such a course that if universally allowed and pursued in such cases would throw human society into confusion. When men obtain a property in any of the professions of this life, they are at the same time also invested with a right to retain a possession of them, till they are deprived of them in some fair and regular proceeding. Every man has a right to hold his estate and keep possession of his property, so that no other can lawfully use them as his own, until he either parts with them of his own accord, or until it be taken from him according to some established rule in a way of open justice. Therefore he who, under pretense of having just demands upon his neighbor, privately takes his goods without his consent, takes them unjustly and is guilty of stealing. Number two, much less will it make such a private taking not to be stealing, that he who takes has, in a way of kindness or gift, done for the persons from whom he takes, as much as is equivalent to the value of what he takes. If a man do his neighbor some considerable kindness, whether in labor or in something that he gives him, what he does or gives is supposed to be done voluntarily, and he is not to make his neighbor debtor for it, and therefore if anything be privately taken away, upon any such consideration, it is gross stealing. For instance, when any person needs to have any services done for him, where a considerable number of hands are necessary, it is common for the neighborhood to meet together and join in helping their neighbor, if frequently some provision is made for their entertainment. If any person who has assisted on such an occasion, and is a partaker at such an entertainment, shall think within himself, "The service I have done is worth a great deal more than what I shall eat and drink here," and therefore shall take liberty privately to take of the provision set before him, to carry away with him, purposely concealing the matter from him who hath entertained him, this is gross stealing, and it is a very ridiculous plea which they make to excuse so unmanly and vile an act. Persons in such cases may say to themselves that the provision is made for them and set before them, that it is a time wherein considerable liberty is given, and they think, seeing they have done so much for their host, they may take something more than they eat and drink there. But then let them be open in it. Let them acquaint those with it who make the entertainment. And let it not be done in any wise or secret manner, with the least design or attempt to avoid their notice. On the contrary, let care be taken to give them notice and obtain their consent. When persons do such things in a private manner, they condemn themselves by their own act. Their doing what they do secretly shows that they are conscious to themselves, that they go beyond what is expected they should do, and do what would not be allowed if it were known. Such an act, however light they make of it, is abominable theft. And what any person of religion or any sense of the dignity of their own nature would to the greatest degree abhor and detest. Number three. It is not sufficient to make a private taking without consent not to be stealing, that it is but a small matter that is taken. If the thing be of little value, yet if it be worth a purpose concealing from the owner, the value is great enough to render the taking of it proper theft. And if it be pretended that the thing is of so small consequence that it is not worth asking for, then surely it is not worth a purpose concealing from the owner when it is taken. He who, under this pretense, conceals his taken, in the very act contradicts his own pretense. For his actions show that he apprehends, or at least suspects, that, as small a matter as it is, the owner would not like the taking of it if he knew it, otherwise the taker would not desire to conceal it. The owner of the goods, and not other people, is a proper judge. Whether what he owns be of such a value that it is worth his while to keep it and to refuse his consent to the taking of it from him. He who possesses and not he who takes away has a right to judge of what consequence his possessions are to him. He has a right to set what value he pleases on them and to treat them according to that value. Besides, merely that a thing is of small value cannot give a right to others purposely and designedly to take it away without the knowledge or consent of the owner. Because if this only gives a right, then all have a right to take things of small value. And at this rate, a great number of persons, each of them taken from a man that which is of a small value, might take away all he has. Therefore, it will not justify persons in purposely taking such things as fruits from the trees or gardens or fields of their neighbors without their knowledge or consent, that the things which they take are things of small value. Nor is that sufficient to render such an act not an act of the theft properly so called. This shows also that the smallness of the value of what is privately taken at feasts and entertainments doth not render the taking of such things not stealing. The small value of a thing may in some cases justify an occasional taking of things, so far as we may from thence and from what is generally allowed reasonably presume that the owner gives his consent. But if that be the case, and persons really take, as supposing that the owner consents to such occasional taking, then he that takes will not at all endeavor to do what he does secretly, nor in any measure to avoid notice. But merely the smallness of the value of a thing can never justify a secret taking of what is another's. Section 4, the subject applied and the dishonest warned. The first use I would make of this doctrine is to warn against all injustice and dishonesty as to what appertains to our neighbor's temporal goods or possessions. Let me warn all to avoid all ways of unjustly invading or usurping what is their neighbor's, and let me press that exhortation of the Apostle, Romans 12:17. Provide things honest in the sight of all men, which implies that those things which we provide for ourselves and use as our own should be such as we come honestly by, and especially that we should avoid all clandestine or underhand ways of obtaining anything that is our neighbor's, either by fraudulent dealing or by that taken without our neighbor's knowledge and consent of which we have been speaking. I warn you to beware of dishonesty and withholding what is your neighbor's, either by unfaithfulness to your trust in any business which you undertake, or by withholding your neighbor's just and honest dues. Consider that saying of the Apostle, Romans 13:8. Owe no man anything but to love one another. Be also warned against wronging your neighbor or injuring him in his enclosures, or in any of his just rights and properties, through careless neglect of what is reasonably expected by neighbors one of another, in order that they may live one by another without mutual injury. Let all beware that they bring not guilt on their souls in the sight of God by taking advantage to oppress any persons. Especially beware of taking advantage of others' poverty to extort from them. For God will defend their cause, and you will be no gainers by such oppression. Beware also of all injustice by deceitful and fraudulent dealing. You doubtless meet with abundance of temptations to fraud, and have need to keep a strong guard upon yourselves. There are many temptations to falsehood in trading, both about what you would buy and what you have to sell. There are, in buying, temptations to do as in Proverbs 20:14. It is not, saith the buyer. There are many temptations to take indirect courses to blind those with whom you deal about the qualities of what you have to sell, to diminish the defects of your commodities or to conceal them, and to put off things for good which are bad. And there are doubtless many other ways that men meet with temptations to deceive others, which your own experience will better suggest to you than I can. But here I shall take occasion to speak of a particular kind of fraud which is very aggravated, and is rather a defrauding of God than man. What I mean is, the giving of that which is bad for good in public contributions. Though it be matter of great shame and lamentation that it should be so, yet it is to be feared, from what has sometimes been observed, that there are some who, when there is a public contribution to be made for the poor, or some other pious and charitable use, sometimes take that opportunity to put off their bad money, that which they find or think their neighbors will refuse to take at their hands, because they will have opportunity to see what is offered them, and to observe the badness of it, even that they therefore take opportunity to put off to God. Hereby they endeavor to save their credit, for they apprehend that they shall be concealed. They appear with others to go to the contribution, as it is not known, but that they put in that which is good. But they cheat the church of God and defraud the expectations of the poor. Or rather, they lie to God, for those who receive what is given stand as Christ's receivers, and not as acting for themselves in this matter. An exhortation to honesty. I shall confine myself to two particulars, many other things having been already spoken to, Number one, I shall hence take occasion to exhort parents to restrain their children from stealing, and particularly from being guilty of theft and stealing the fruits of their neighbor's trees or fields. Christian parents are obliged to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, but how much otherwise do they act who bring them up in theft? And those parents are guilty of this who, though they do not directly teach them to steal, by example in setting them about it, yet tolerate them in it. Parents should take effectual care, not only to instruct their children better, and to warn them against any such thiefish practices, but also thoroughly to restrain them. Children who practice stealing make themselves vile. Stealing by the common consent of mankind is a very vile practice. Therefore, those parents that will not take thorough care to restrain their children from such a practice will be guilty of the same sin which God so highly resented and awfully punished in Eli, of which we read in 1 Samuel 3:13, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile and he restrained them not." Number two. I exhort those who are conscious in themselves that they have heretofore wronged their neighbor to make restitution. This is a duty, the obligation to which is exceedingly plain. If a person was wronged in taking away anything that was his, certainly he is wronged also in detaining it. And all the while that a person who has been guilty of wronging his neighbor neglects to make restitution, he lives in that wrong. He not only lives impenitent as to that first wrong of which he was guilty, but he continually wrongs his neighbor. A man who has gotten anything from another wrongfully goes on to wrong him every day that he neglects to restore it when he has opportunity to do it. The person injured did not only suffer wrong from the other when his goods were first taken from him, but he suffers new injustice from him all the while they are unjustly kept from him. Therefore, I counsel you who are conscious that you have heretofore wronged your neighbor, either by fraud or oppression, or unfaithfulness or stealing, whether lately or formerly, though it may have been a great while ago, speedily to go and make restitution for all the wrong your neighbor has suffered at your hands. That it was done long ago doth not quit you from obligation to restore. This is a duty with which you must comply. You cannot be acquitted without it. As long as you neglect it, it will be unreasonable in you to expect any forgiveness of God. For what ground can you have to think that God will pardon you as long as you willfully continue in the same wrong and wrong the same man still every day by detaining from him that which is his? You in your prayers ask of God that he would forgive all your sins, but your very prayers are mockery if you still willfully continue in those sins. Indeed, if you go and confess your faults to your neighbor and he will freely acquit you from making restitution, you will be acquitted from the obligation, for in so doing your neighbor gives you what before was his, but otherwise you cannot be acquitted. I would leave this advice with all for direction in their behavior on their death beds. Indeed, you should not by any means put it off till you come to die, and you will run the most fearful risk in so doing. But if you will not do it now, while you are in health, I will leave it with you to remember when you shall come to lie on your deathbeds. Doubtless, then if you have the use of your reason, you will be concerned for the salvation of your poor souls. And let this one thing be remembered as absolutely necessary in order to your salvation, that before you die you must make restitution for whatever wrong you shall have done any of your neighbors, or at least leave orders that such restitution be made. Otherwise you will, as it were, go out of the world and go before your great judge with stolen goods in your hands. And certainly it will not be very comfortable or safe to bring them into his infinitely holy and dreadful presence when he sits on a throne of judgment with his eyes as a flame of fire, being more pure than to look on iniquity when he is about to sentence you to your everlasting, unalterable state. Everyone here present who has been guilty of wronging his neighbor and has not made restitution must die. Let all such therefore remember this counsel now given them on the day when death shall approach, if they shall be so foolish as to neglect it till that time.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."